From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm Jenna Gibson. For this week's episode, we are taking a look back at the Pyeongchang Olympics, but of course, there was a lot going on. We had the sports stories and the triumphs of the different athletes, but of course, we also had the geopolitical implications of North Korea attending, Vice President Pence going to the opening ceremonies, and how he interacted or did not interact with the North Koreans. So I wanted to step back and get a little bit of a broader view on what happened at Pyeongchang the last couple of weeks. And with that in mind, my guest tonight is Jonathan Cheng, who is the bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal based in Seoul. He was covering the Olympics along with his team and had a lot of different experiences that he is sharing here today on the podcast. So without further ado, let's get into the conversation with John Cheng. Just to start off with, start from the beginning, I guess, can you talk a little bit about what it was like in the lead up to Pyeongchang before all this North Korea stuff, which I do want to talk about? What was the atmosphere like living in Seoul as Korea was preparing for this event?
Well, I think the most striking thing about the lead up to the Pyeongchang Olympics, at least from a Seoul perspective, is that there was hardly any buzz or excitement really about it. Obviously, Olympics are well signposted and everyone knows in theory that it's coming up, but it always felt very far away. 2018 didn't seem like it was imminent almost until the calendar flipped from 2017 to 2018. And then you started to have people realize, oh, hey, this thing is really going to happen soon. But at least from a Seoul perspective, there wasn't a whole lot going on, although I'm sure behind the scenes in Pyeongchang and Gangneung itself, there was obviously a lot of preparation work that had to be done to pull off these Olympics.
Yeah, I got a similar sense, too, that it was kind of, when I would visit Korea or, working on Korea issues, it was kind of like, oh, at some point the Olympics will take place and at some point hopefully they will go well, but it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't on the forefront of people's minds in a really strange way.
Yeah, and I can tell you that even within the Wall Street Journal, we were trying to make our preparations and our plans for it. I've never been to an Olympics before, and I've certainly never covered one before, so I wasn't quite sure what to expect. But I know that when we were in the summer last year, just trying to plan ahead for the Olympics, it really just felt like it was so far away. It was actually hard to stay motivated because, well, obviously the summer's warm and you're not thinking about winter sports at all. And we knew intellectually that it was close, but it was just hard to think about that, especially when there was so much else going on this summer, including everything with North Korea and Trump and Twitter and everything else.
Right. Yeah. And even 2016 was a crazy year. So 2016 to 17, it was kind of like the Korean Peninsula never slept. So I can understand that too.
Exactly.
So I definitely want to ask about this because it did seem like the Olympics, like you were saying, it's kind of far away. It was a little removed. And then all of a sudden, bam, this North Korea stuff comes in. They reached out via the phone line, and then all of a sudden, a week later, there's all these talks, and something happened very, very quickly. So I'm wondering, from a coverage perspective, how did that all go down, and how was covering those discussions?
On January the 1st, we know that we get a speech from Kim Jong-un every year, and we know that it's going to be parsed and analyzed and examined from every which way. What's interesting is that I don't think really expected there to be such a strong outreach from Kim. And in fact, the first day after it happened, if you'll recall, a lot of the emphasis in our coverage, but also in others, was that you had this language about a nuclear button being on Kim's desk. You had talk about him saying that we've reached a milestone in terms of our nuclear missile program, that we need to start mass producing some of this arsenal, and that was really where the focus was. It is true that he also reached out to the South on the Olympics, but I don't think that that narrative really took off on its own until Moon reciprocated. Perhaps you could say that we missed the story there in hindsight, or that we as the press missed the story. But of course, every year North Korea will make an outreach of some sort in the New Year's speech. And it was different this time because it mentioned the Olympics very specifically, but that's only because the Olympics weren't happening in the other years. And so that to us felt very boilerplate. And perhaps it was, perhaps it wasn't until Moon really reciprocated in a very strong way that the ball really got rolling. But of course, the ball wouldn't have gotten rolling unless the North was ready to push ahead with this. So it does seem like there obviously was some design in this, that even though Moon had already been in power for 7 months or something like that by that point, nearly 7 months, it's clear that North Korea was ready by January the 1st to get the wheels rolling on the Pyeongchang Olympics, even though everything in those first 6.5 months were North Korea basically dismissing South Korea, saying, you guys aren't relevant here. All we really want to talk to, the only people we really want to talk to are the Americans. We have no interest in your Pyeongchang Olympics. And every time Moon would raise it, and he would raise it in speeches, North Korea would sort of brush him aside. So that to me is still the big unanswered question here, which is, why was North Korea suddenly so willing to participate in the Olympics? And there are many theories that you could take from there, but I still think that's kind of the central question.
Yeah, I think it will be really, really interesting to see, you know, now that we have possible overtures. I mean, you know, it's unclear how sincere or not, or possibly talking with the U.S. Of course, Moon has been invited to Pyongyang, so that's a big step as well. So I will be very curious the next 6 months to see the continuation of the Olympic diplomacy, because I think that will give us some insight too on which of these theories may be more correct than others.
Yeah, to me, it really comes down to the classic question, which is one that you could ask after any sort of major event in North Korea, whether it be the execution of Jang Sung-taek or whether it be the decision to send athletes to the Olympics. The question is always, is Kim Jong-un doing this from a position of strength or from a position of weakness? If you're thinking from a position of strength, then the argument goes, they've finished their nuclear and missile program to a satisfactory level. They're now at the point where they're ready to declare victory. So let's do this Olympics almost as a victory lap or something like that. Maybe that's one way to think about it. Then if you think about it as a position of weakness, then the argument there might go, sanctions have really started to take a bite on North Korea. They now realize that the noose is tightening around them. Not only is the U.S. and all of its allies all united, but even China and Russia might be squeezing us as well. We need a lifeline from the South Koreans, because they've always been they bailed us out after the famine, you could say, and now there's a left-leaning administration in the Blue House, so this is the time to do this. And, you know, just the timing of it, the fact that Kim essentially ignored Moon's overtures for so many months, and then with, what, like 6 weeks to go, fewer than 6 weeks to go before the Olympics starts, he suddenly says, let's do this. And needless to say, Moon Jae-in, this is sort of the opening that he's been looking for, and he's got to move quickly. And, you know, the Olympics are an event that take years of preparation, and to suddenly bring in about 500 North Koreans at the last minute is going to take a lot of scrambling and a lot of logistical work. And to their credit, they pulled it off without anything major happening, and you know, there could have been a catastrophe either logistically or politically or in some other respect. But by having Kim reach out to Moon so close to the Olympics, it really left South Korea with not a whole lot of time to really process it and to really think about it. It seemed like a race just to make it logistically happen.
Right. One thing that I'm really curious about is, for you as a journalist, you're, you know, there to cover the Pyeongchang Olympics. There's a million events that you could be going to at any given time. And meanwhile, you have all the North Korean delegation there as well that obviously are newsworthy. So how did you and your team balance that? How did you choose to approach the coverage of the Olympics, considering that there was this added at the last minute with the North Koreans?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are fortunate at the Wall Street Journal to have a pretty large team. We have sent a large number of sports reporters to to the Olympics over the past 10 years. I think Beijing 2008 may have been the first time we really went for it. And that sort of was because we had a new owner there. We had a new infusion of money. There was a new push into sports. And also the Beijing 2008 Olympics will probably go down as one of the more significant Olympics in modern history, just because of what it meant for China and for the world. But since then, we've sort of carried it on. And so we've now got a pack of roving Olympics reporters that includes our sports team, but also coverage reporters from all sorts of different areas that have become Olympic veterans. So we had, you know, about a dozen of them come and join us, and they were the ones taking care of speed skating, figure skating, alpine skiing, all those sorts of things. I mean, here in South Korea, we're just not equipped. Our bureau was not ready to jump in here and write about the intricacies of biathlon. So we were really, really, really lucky to have them come and take care of all of that for us. And then Korea Bureau, our job was really to handle the Korea aspect of things. So on the sports side, that does mean short track speed skating and some of the places where South Korea does do well medal-wise, but also to look at the political implications of everything that was happening. That would have been true even if North Korea did not send a delegation. We still would have had a lot to write about on that angle. But once the North Koreans confirmed that they were coming, then we really had to redouble our efforts in that realm. And so we essentially had one of our reporters more or less keep tabs on what the North Koreans were doing every day, and to the best of our abilities, try and track them down and follow them around and see what we could figure out. And, you know, I mean, I think the key is to be flexible when the Olympics come around. I think what we learned from our Olympic veteran colleagues is that you never really know what narrative is going to take over until the Olympics starts. And they point to Rio and that whole Ryan Lochte thing, which obviously no one could have prepared for, and yet that became sort of a big thing. And as we all know, here in Korea, the curling, the women's curling team was something that sort of emerged out of nowhere and became a narrative, and that's certainly something we couldn't have planned for before. But once it happens, you sort of got to be flexible and be able to jump on whatever the big story is. And so that was sort of my position. I was writing about what we knew was going to be a big story, which was the North Koreans, which was Mike Pence coming and then Kim Yo-jong coming and what would happen between them. But once they were all gone after day three or day four, whenever it was, then it was really remaining flexible so that we could jump on the Garlic Girls story when that emerged.
So I'm glad you brought this up, because as anyone who follows you on Twitter knows, and you all should, audience, this was a big thing for you, and you've almost gotten a little bit of notoriety, I guess might not be the right word, for your love of the Garlic Girls. And you were even in like South Korean news as them quoting you on Twitter loving the curling team. So what was that like? What drew you to this team and drew a lot of people? I mean, they are overnight sensations. What is it about this team that draws people?
Well, I mean, maybe best to start at the beginning. As I wrote in one of the columns, or well, the only column I wrote for this, my only sports column ever, and maybe ever in the future, but sports editor asked me to write a column, and I mentioned there that I was born and raised in Canada, which is true, and I have curled once in high school. I can't remember what the context was anymore, but we all went down to the curling rink, and I had my chance to throw a stone and sweep the ice and do all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I grew up in a country where you can turn on the TV and there actually is curling on TV a lot of the time, and it's so it's not a foreign sport to me, but at the same time I get the humor of it. It's not a very Olympian sort of endeavor, at least to the casual viewer, and so there's always a little bit of inbuilt humor there. And in the lead up to the Olympics, I had no idea who any of these Garlic Girls were. I didn't know that South Korea had a team that could possibly be in contention at all. I figured, like the men's ice hockey team, like the women's ice hockey team, these were teams that were basically kind of thrown together because, oh my God, we're going to host the Olympics. We better have something to show for in all of these sports. But, you know, when I saw that Korea had beaten Canada, which is the reigning, you know, champions, that made me notice. I wasn't there at the time. I was busy chasing Mike Pence around or something at that time. And I went to their second game, but I went to their second game only because they were playing Japan. And we were looking at that rivalry, of course, between South Korea and Japan. And so I went to watch them and they lost. And so their record at that point was 1-1. And I just sort of thought to myself, well, okay, well, that's the last time I'll ever set foot in the curling arena. And what actually brought me back was the Canadians losing for a third time. And when the Canadians had gone down 0-3, I went back to the curling rink again, because if they were eliminated, that would be quite a big shock for Canada. And I figured there'd be a short little Olympic item to write there for the journal. And I did write my first curling piece, actually, was more focused on the Canadian team losing. But when I was there, I watched another South Korean curling game, watched them win again, and I watched them go to 3-1, even as the Canadians were barely struggling to win their first game. And from there, I just sort of caught the fever, just watching these women take down all of these giants. They basically took down the top two countries, Canada and Switzerland, and then they went on to take out Russia and Sweden and Great Britain and every other team. And you know, these women are ranked 8th in the world, so they really should have had no right to be doing this well. And as the momentum sort of picked up, that's when it just sort of took on a life of its own.
I feel like the answer to this might be related to the Garlic Girls, but maybe you have another one as well. But were there any moments that really took you by surprise, or that as you're covering this and trying to remain flexible, any anecdotes that you can share that were really unexpected?
Yeah, I mean, at first it sort of became an internal joke among us. Probably roughly 15 of us at the journal all sort of had our shared chat room. And it sort of became a quick early punchline that I was always going to be hanging out at the curling center. And when I first started tweeting about it, I got a lot of let's call it skepticism from people who wanted, you know, anything but curling. And there were a lot of people who were making fun of me, a lot of people who were making fun of the sport. And before you knew it, the bandwagon was getting very full. And at our peak, I think it was for the semifinal against Japan, we had 9 of our reporters in the curling center at one time. And that's like 2/3 of our team, including a lot of the guys who made fun of me. And Anna Fifield over at the Washington Post was an early skeptic. She was railing on me pretty hard, and so there she was for the finals as well.
Did you draw them in? Was it you? You made them all believers?
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of people have said that I had some responsibility for all of this, but I mean, I really don't think so, in that the South Korean press was all over this as well. And look, they won a silver medal, and they became memes. And I certainly had nothing to do with them being called the Garlic Girls. I had nothing to do with them giving themselves these cute nicknames. I had nothing to do with them, you know, going viral for their Young Me chant, for some of the little videos that people were making in their own homes. That had nothing to do with me. So I think for perhaps an English language audience, I provided a convenient gateway for some of these people. But the phenomenon was very domestic and very organic. And, you know, I feel like I was riding the wave. I wasn't generating the waves by any means.
I'm wondering, to circle back to the beginning, we had been talking about how, in a way, Pyeongchang always seemed far off, or it wasn't on the forefront of people's minds. I'm wondering how the narrative is now there in Korea. Do people feel that it was a success? Do people feel they're happy with how things turned out? What is the South Korean media or the sentiment there now?
Well, I think there's no question that the games went off very well from just a hosting point of view. Logistically, especially when you compare it to Sochi or to Rio or to some of the other previous Olympics, mostly without a hitch. You obviously had a norovirus scare at the beginning, but that was contained in the end. There were concerns about transportation and about housing and about volunteers and all these sorts of things, but none of them really materialized in any way to dent the spirit. Then you have the question of whether or not they were a success from a geopolitical, diplomatic, inter-Korean point of view. And I don't know that we're going to have an answer for that until a couple months from now. I think it really will be judged through the lens of what comes after the Olympics. If we go right back to where we were last year, I think most people are going to say, well, Moon was played by the North Koreans. This was a feint all along. And if it does lead to some traction with talks, even if they don't ultimately succeed, I think people are going to look back on this and say, well, look, it was worth a try, and it was successful in that regard. And if it failed, it wasn't because of the Olympics, it was in spite of the Olympics. But I really do think that that will be determined by what we see after the Paralympics are over and we get into the April exercises and the launch season.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Paralympics. I was going to ask you about that because, of course, in a way, things have wrapped up for the Olympics, but it's not over for Pyeongchang. They still have the Paralympics to go. So are you going to be covering that as well? Or what's the plan for the Paralympics?
Yeah, well, we like, I think, a lot of the world are a little bit burnt out by the Olympics. And there's a lot that we've been neglecting back here that we're getting to. And some of us will be taking our vacations simply because we haven't had any days off for the past 3 weeks. But I think that we'll definitely be keeping an eye on it. I am not planning to cover it. We aren't planning to cover it. We may end up going out there just to check out some of the events. Now that there's that KTX line, it's very easy to get in and out of Gangneung and Pyeongchang. And I have people who tell me that the Paralympics are even better to watch than the Olympics, and I believe them, and I want to see it for myself. But in terms of the geopolitical value, certainly it's going to be lower there. I don't think we're expecting as many high-level visitors as we do for the Olympics. We get, I think, the Secretary for Homeland Security from the U.S. is going to be coming. We know that the North Korean athletes will be coming, but they aren't going to be sending their cheerleaders. So it will be lower scale. I don't know what the percentage size is, Paralympics versus Olympics, but we obviously know it is much smaller in terms of the number of athletes that compete, the number of countries that compete, and the number of spectators that come out. So I've always personally wondered why there's probably an answer for it, but I've always wondered why they don't hold the Paralympics first. I just think it makes more sense to do that and put the spotlight on them first so that there's some build up to inevitably what's going to be the bigger attraction, which is the Olympics. But they haven't done that here, and so I do think that it's likely to be overshadowed not only by the Olympics, but also by questions of what happens once the Paralympics close on March the 18th, because that's when this Olympic truce sort of comes to an end, and that's when we get into the next season.
Right, absolutely. Definitely something that I know you'll be watching closely, I'll be watching closely. Before we go, I just want to give you a chance. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you think is important or any interesting stories you want to share before we close out?
Well, I mean, the only other thing I wanted to say, I think, is just what I think I loved the most about the women's curling story is that just the nature of the sport has really allowed it to kind of play itself out as a narrative. When you look at the Yoon Sung-bin gold medal in skeleton or many of the other events, especially on the slopes where, you know, the athletes are done in a matter of seconds. Most of the time it's 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, and they're done. By the time the world has found out about them and learns their story and learns about where they came from and how they came into the sport and all their ups and downs, they're not competing anymore. They're done. That's it. They can take their photos, but they're not ever going to be suiting up again and winning another gold medal or competing again. The great thing about the Garlic Girls or the women's curling team here is that when the buzz started to build, there was still plenty of time for them to play again and again and again and again and to really build up a fan base. And I think that's really what happened here. And everyone's looking at the Olympics more cynically these days because of corruption, because of the money that's involved, because of all of those sort of political things. And yet once the Olympics begins, there's always a feel-good narrative that comes out of it and reminds you why we have these Olympics to begin with. And for me, and I think for many others, that was really the women's curling team here. And it was a great story, and it was great to be a part of it in some small way.
I want to end it there because that's such a positive note, and I totally agree with you. So, John, thank you so much for your time, and good luck. Hopefully you're able to take a little bit of vacation too.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Thanks everyone for joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're getting your podcasts. And do check out some of our other content. KEI does have a blog, blog.keia.org, and we're posting all kinds of content there, as well as on our Twitter, which is KoreaEconInst. Thank you again for joining us, and we hope to see you again next week.